we left Esther at a moment of decision, okay? Mordecai has come and said there's this evil plot by the wicked Haman. Ooh, remember? And you're in the right place at the right time, surrounded by the right people in order to do this work. And Esther says, not me. You don't understand. This can't be right. And Mordecai comes back to her and says, who knows whether you are here for such a time as this? And we have that same decision, don't we? Are we going to live out God's purpose today, regardless of what our circumstances are, regardless of where we are, regardless of what's going on? Are we going to stand in the moment and look like Jesus, or are we going to kind of try to hide away? Have you made your decision? Here's Esther's decision. So we open it back up to Esther chapter 4, and we're going to start in verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. So Esther listens to Mordecai, and he listens to his wisdom, and maybe I am here in this moment for such a time as this. And she says, okay, go and gather up the Jews. We're going to spend some time in prayer, fasting. And then I'll go to the king. And I think it's important that in this moment, when Esther decides, okay, I'm willing to be an open door for God's work. I'm willing to be available. I'm willing to stand in the moment and do what God has called me to do. She does three things to prepare to do that, okay? She does three things to prepare to do that. The first thing that she does is she surrounds herself with a community of God's people. She surrounds herself with a community of God's people. That's good news for you and me. Because what that means is we don't do this by ourselves. We can't do it alone. She says, I need help. And I think that's a good thing. Because a lot of times when I'm in a place where I'm struggling, what is it hard to do? It's hard to say, I need help. It's hard to say, I need help. And it's hard to say that because we feel what? We feel like if I say I need help, then I'm not as strong as I should be, right? I'm weaker than I should be. And I don't want you to see me as weak. I want you to see me as strong. And so I want to manage that. And so I kind of hide behind that. It makes us vulnerable. It requires us to be open, doesn't it? And that's a hard thing sometimes. It's a hard thing to say, I need help. I need you. But that's one of the things that Esther teaches us, that if we're going to live out God's purpose, regardless of our circumstances, regardless of our life situations, one of the things we have to do is we have to do it together. Okay? And that's why God's people are so important. That's why he wants us to be bound up with a church family. Not just show up on Sunday mornings and sneak in and sneak out, but connected, interwoven together, so that we can help each other be all that God calls us to be. Makes sense? And so he wants us to be a people who are surrounded by other people who love God, who are willing and committed to helping us live out our purpose. The second thing she does is, what are those people going to do together? They're going to fast, okay? And when we see the word fast, we ought to see the word pray, okay? One of the interesting things about the book of Esther is that God is never mentioned in the book of Esther, okay? The name of God is never mentioned. And it's kind of, it's almost kind of for dramatic effect. He's not mentioned, and because he's not mentioned, you see him so clearly, okay? So they're going to spend 3 days saturating this circumstance with prayer. And I love that. Together, they're going to go to God and they're going to say, we need you. We need you. And they're going to cover this thing in prayer. Because who is the only one who can really make a difference in our lives? God. Do I have the strength or the power to change my life myself? No, not really. We can try. We can change pieces of it, maybe, of our outside circumstances. But the only one who can really help me live out my purpose is God. I don't have the power to do that myself. And so we're going to go to God in prayer. And we're going to saturate that moment in prayer. And then the third thing that she does is when she says, I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Okay? What is she doing there? Okay, this is a word that I'm going to use. It's called surrender. She's going to surrender to God's timing, to God's plan and God's movement, even if it costs a sacrifice, even if it requires a sacrifice. What is surrender? Surrender is one of those interesting words. In our culture, in our American culture in specific, surrender is a good word or a bad word? It's a bad word, isn't it? Okay? It means that you've lost. It means you're not in control. It means you're the loser, okay, is what surrender would mean. You have to give up. But surrender in the Christian context is a word of beauty. It's a word of power. It's a word of strength. It's the only word that empowers us to live the life God wants us to live. The dictionary definition of surrender is to give yourself into the power and control of another. To give yourself into the power and control of another. And isn't that the definition of what it means to be a Christian? To give yourself into the power and control of... Okay, that's right, but the right answer is always... Okay, so try again. So we're going to give ourselves into the power and control of Jesus. And that's a good place to stand, isn't it? When we live under the power and control of Jesus, do we win or do we lose? We win. Regardless of what's happening in the world, regardless of our circumstances, we win because we stand with Jesus, okay? And so that's what she does. She surrounds herself. That's the first thing she does. She saturates the situation with prayer, and then she surrenders to what it is that God has called her to do. And that's how she prepares for the moment. Okay? So let's go on and see what happens. Chapter 5. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne, inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Did God answer their prayers? You have to imagine that that was the first prayer first in a line of prayers that they prayed. But the first one was that Esther would be accepted, that she'd even get to speak. And so that had to give her courage, didn't it? That had to help her to see that scepter come out. And she knows that that's not the king. That's God at work. That's God at work. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, even up to half my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a..." Yeah, good one. "To a feast that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Queen Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. So what's the next thing that happens? The king extends the scepter, and so Esther has her life, okay? Because if he hadn't done that, what would have happened? She would have died right then, okay? But he extends the scepter, and she looks at the moment, and what does she do? She says, I want you to come to dinner. I want you to come to dinner. And the king says, "Okay, quickly, let's get Haman, let's go to dinner." Boo, thank you. I got one person. All right? So she asked the king and the Haman to come to dinner. And they go to dinner, and they're talking, and they're having dinner, and they get to after dinner, and the king goes, "Okay, Esther, tell me, what is it that you really, really want?" And again, she looks at the moment, and she's very patient, and she says, "I want you to come to dinner again tomorrow. And when you come tomorrow, then I will explain to you what it is that I need." All right? And so that happens. So the king says, okay, we'll come to dinner tomorrow. And they all go their own separate ways. Well, Haman, he's feeling pretty good about the day's events, right? I mean, he's kind of power hungry, kind of ambitious, and who's gotten invited to dinner? It's the king, the queen, and Haman. Boo, right? And so he's going home, but as he's going home, he passes by Mordecai. And he goes, this guy will not bow down. And he gets so mad, and he gets so upset. And he says, nothing is worth living if Mordecai lives. His wife, whose name is Zeresh, says, well, here's what you do. Build a gallows 50 feet high and go to the king tomorrow and ask to hang Mordecai on the gallows. And Haman, boo, says, that sounds like a good idea. And so he gets his guys to build a 50-foot, think about it, a 50-foot gallows out in front of his house. Do you think that caused any questions? You know, anyway, he's building a 50-foot gallows out, and in the morning, I'm going to go ask the king for Mordecai's life. So he goes to bed. But the king goes to bed, and he can't sleep. And we have this whole night in which, again, God's name is not mentioned, but we can see God working over and over and over again. The king can't sleep, okay? So there's lots of things that a king can do or have. I mean, he could order out for ice cream, or he could do anything he wants. But he says, bring the Chronicles in, and let's read a boring book is what I really think what he was saying. Bring a boring book and see if they'll read it to me. Maybe I'll fall asleep. So the guy who's in charge of reading the Chronicles goes to the Chronicle closet and pulls out a chronicle. And he just happens to pull out a chronicle that has a story in it about how Mordecai saved the king's life. Whose hand was involved in that? God's hand. And so the chronicler reads to the king, and he's reading about Mordecai and how he saved his life. And the king goes, well, what good thing did we do for him? We need to do a good thing for him because he saved my life. What did we do? And the guy goes, we didn't do anything for him. We need to do something good for him. Who can we ask about what a good thing would be? And just about that time, Haman's walking in the door. That's right. And so Haman's walking in the door. He goes, Haman, boo, come here. I got a question for you. What should we do for someone in whom the king delights? Now, Haman, being Haman, says, well, who would the king delight in more than me? I mean, that's what he says, literally. There's no one else the king. And so he comes with this elaborate plan, dressing the person whom the king delights in his robe and riding his horse and having somebody walk through the streets going, this is what happens to the person the king delights in. Because Haman thinks it's going to happen to him, right? And the king looks and Haman says, that is a great idea. Go do that for Mordecai. And what does God do? He saves Mordecai's life and gives a warning to Haman. Don't mess with my people. So Mordecai gets on the horse, and Haman has to walk through the streets with Mordecai going, this is what the king delights in. Okay, and he goes home, and he's so upset. And what are we going to do? And his wife goes, oh, you better leave him alone. And right about that moment, they come and say, it's time to go to dinner at Queen Esther's house. So they come and get him. And so we pick it up again. Where am I here? Oh, chapter 7. Okay? So the king and Haman went in to feast with Queen Esther. Verse 1, chapter 7, verse 1. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, what is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Even to half of my kingdom it should be fulfilled. Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not compared with the loss to the king. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, who is he, and where is he? Who has dared to do this? And Esther said, a foe, an enemy, this wicked Haman. See? Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And it goes on, the king gets angry, and Haman tries to beg for his life for Queen Esther, and they take him out and they hang him on the gallows that he built in front of his own house, and the people, and the Queen Esther works with Mordecai, and the people are saved. And the people are saved. And her act of courage, her act of going before the king, doesn't just change the history for those Jews on that day. It has changed the history for every single person in this room. Because who was a Jew? The right answer is always Jesus. And because of Jesus, we're all here. And because of Jesus, every person on this planet has the opportunity to walk with God. One action by one ordinary woman in a situation she didn't want to be in changed the world. That's a pretty amazing story, isn't it? But what did we talk about at the beginning? Her story is my story. Her story is your story. So what do we learn from Esther about how to live in our purpose? I guess I still have it. About how to live in our purpose. How do we live that with that way? Okay? I think we have three things, and then we'll be done for the day. The first one is that we have to dig deep for courage. We have to dig deep for courage. First of all, I think we need to define courage. Courage is not the absence of fear, okay? It's not wrong to be afraid. It is wrong to let fear stop you, okay? I read somewhere that it's okay for fear to be a comma, just don't let it be a period. So those of you who are grammar kind of people, you got that one. It's okay for it to give us pause, but don't let us stop it. Don't let it stop us. Courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is the confidence that God is able, that God is big, and that God is in control. And we look at the moment and we look at the circumstance and say, you know what? I'm going to step into that confidence even though I am afraid. Okay? And so we have to dig deep for courage. And there really is just something about taking a deep breath and saying, I'm afraid, but I'm going to step anyway. Does that make sense? And so we're going to have to dig deep for courage. If we're going to live the life of purpose that God calls us to be, we're going to have to be women of courage. Because is our world going to make that easy? No. Our world is not going to make that easy. We may not have Haman in specific. Boo. But do we have Hamans in our world? Do we have enemies? Do we have people and organizations and just forces in our world that want us to be quiet, that want us to hide, that don't want us to step out and look like Jesus? We do, don't we? We've watched over the last couple weeks what's happening in the Middle East with Christians who are being beheaded because they will not renounce the name of Jesus. And we don't, as of yet, face that kind of persecution here, but there's economic persecution, and there's social persecution, and cultural persecution, and it's building, and it's going to take courage to stand up and face that. The second thing that we're going to have to do, we're going to have to dig deep for courage, is we're going to have to grow in wisdom. We're going to have to grow in wisdom. One of the things that I admire about Esther is that she was very wise. You know, that she came into the throne room, and the throne room's got to be filled with all kinds of people who are looking for audience for the king, and there's advisors and soldiers, and who knows who all is in there. And Esther doesn't get the scepter extended to her and just blurt out what she wants. She looks at the moment and says, this needs to be handled differently, okay? And so she shows herself to be very wise, and then she doesn't do it the first night. She waits until the second night, and she handles that in a really wise way. And so if we're going to be women who live in God's purpose, we're going to have to grow in wisdom, okay? And again, I'm going to define wisdom, because I think it's one of those words we talk about, we don't really know how to define. I think that wisdom is doing the right thing at the right time in the right way. Doing the right thing at the right time in the right way. Sometimes I don't do the right thing. We'll just start there. Sometimes I just don't do the right thing. Sometimes I do the right thing, but I don't do it at the right time. Have you ever sat in a situation and gone, oh, I wish I had, you know, I had one of those moments this week. Tolkien, I wish I had. I figured out the right thing to do, but I didn't figure it out at the right time. So we struggle with that, right? And sometimes I do the right thing, and I do it at the right time, but I don't do it with the right heart. I don't do it with the right attitude. I don't do it in the right way. But wisdom is where those all three merge, doing the right thing at the right time in the right way. So we need to grow in wisdom so that we know how to behave as women of purpose, as women of hope, as women of courage. So how do we grow in wisdom? I can think of three ways that we can grow in wisdom. First of all, James 1:15 tells us what? If we want to be wise, we need to ask God for wisdom. Pray is one of the ways we can ask God. We can say, I want to grow in wisdom. I want to be wiser. Please help me be wiser. So we can pray for wisdom. And what does it say? That he will give it to us. Okay? He will give it to us. I think that that's a growing process, but he'll give us wisdom. The second thing that I think is so essential to growing in wisdom is Bible study. Okay? Is Bible study. Bible study, the Bible is where God reveals himself to us. And God is all wise. And so it shows us how he moves and when he moves and how he works in the lives of people and who he calls us to be. And so investing ourselves in Bible study is critical if we're going to be women of wisdom, okay? And it's important that we not just read for information, but that we read for what I'm going to say is transformation, okay? Is information important? Nod your head like this, yes, okay? I'm a big believer that you should know all the kings of the northern kingdom in order and how to spell them, all right? Yeah. Jeroboam. Okay. Anyway, I think the information is important, okay? You can't move forward if you don't have the information. But if we stop at information, that's not enough. Then it's just a history lesson, okay? The Bible is written, the Bible works in such a way that it's supposed to go deep down inside of us and change who we are. And that's where wisdom comes from, when it becomes a part of who we are. When we learn it, when it's written on our hearts, when it's written on our minds, when it changes the way we think and changes the way we see and changes the way we move. Obviously, I am passionate about Bible study, okay? But I think that that is so, so, so critical. Studies have shown that if you want to grow spiritually, the single most important thing you can do is Bible study. The other stuff's important too. I'm not saying it's not. But if you want to grow spiritually, the biggest thing that you're going to get for your buck is from Bible study. You will grow faster, you will grow farther if you will invest yourself in Bible study, okay? We cannot underestimate the importance of that. So investing in Bible study is going to help us grow in wisdom. And I think that that's an amazing thing. The third thing that we do to grow in wisdom is that we surround ourselves with godly people. Do we help each other grow in wisdom? Sure we do. Sure we do. We learn from each other. And so if you want to grow in wisdom, you surround yourself with wise people. If you want to look like Jesus, what do we need to do? Surround yourself with people who look like Jesus, and they help you take those steps. They inspire you. They encourage you. Okay? And that's part of that power of older women and younger women, right? Everybody just cringed. It's okay. Okay? We're all older. We're all younger. Okay? Except for Miss Lola. She's 103. But 104. I missed it. That's right. She's 104. Okay? But Miss Lola would also be the first person to tell you she's still learning. And so that's an amazing thing. We all have something to teach. We all have something to learn. And we learn wisdom from each other. So we need to dig deep for courage. We need to grow in wisdom. And the third thing we need to do is keep it simple. Keep it simple. I think that a lot of times we think about living out our purpose and looking like Jesus in these grand terms. It has to be something big. It has to be something spectacular. It has to be something with fireworks and burning bushes and handwriting on the wall. God is not only willing, he is very able to work in the ordinary. In fact, I think he prefers it. He likes to work in the ordinary. He likes to crawl into the normal. He likes to come alongside us in our everyday and take those moments and fill them with himself and help us stand there in really neat ways, whether it's in our laundry or at the grocery store or in the carpool line or with our kids or with our grandkids. He wants us to work in the normal, everyday kind of places, okay? And I think that that's an amazing thing. Sometimes we think we have to do really big things for God. God is big. God can take care of the big things. He wants us to do our regular stuff with him and for him and in his name. So I think that there are three pieces to this keeping it simple thing that, again, we learned from Esther. The first one is we have to, this thing keeps, I think Bill has a bigger head than I do, and his microphone doesn't fit. We have to train our eyes to see God's fingerprints. We have to train our eyes to see God's fingerprints. That's one of the things that happens in the book of Esther, is that over and over and over, you can go, there was God, there was God, there was God. And that's a neat moment. Why is it important to learn to see God in the everyday? It makes us look, is God in the everyday? Okay, I'm gonna ask that question again. I want everybody to say yes. Is God in the everyday?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, he is, because God is everywhere. Sometimes I think that we think, you know, yes, we expect to see him in a church building or, you know, in a Bible study or something like that, but we don't necessarily expect to see him at Walmart or at the post office or in the carpool line. And yet, is he in those places? He is. How do we learn to see him? We learned by practicing, okay? We learn by practicing. And the best way to practice is to find the things that you're thankful for. Okay, that's the easiest way to start, is to find the things that you're thankful for. In the carpool line, at the bank, at the grocery store, wherever, and go, what am I thankful for right here, right now? Because we're told that every good and perfect gift comes from above. Okay, so if it's a good and perfect gift, where is it from? It's from above, it's from God, okay? And so we can look and go, if this is a good and perfect gift, then God has been here, all right? And so we walk through that, and we learn to see, and we practice. Now, my oldest son, Ryan, he played the bass in the orchestra, you know, the big tall in the back. And his music teacher told him, only practice on the days you eat. All right, so what did that mean?
Every day.
Every day, okay? Every day, practice on the days you eat. Practice isn't something you can do just once in a while. If you want to become good at something, what do you have to do? Practice every day. And so we learn to see God's fingerprints, and the reason that we learn to see God's fingerprints is because when we see God, what do we want to do? We want to thank him. We want to join him. Okay? We want to be where God is moving. That's our job. Okay? And so the quicker we get at seeing him, the easier it is to move to where he is. And that's what he calls us to do. Another way that we keep it simple is meet the need that God puts in your path. Meet the need that God puts in your path. And I'm going to underline the word "your" there. Because I think that sometimes we look around and we go, oh, look what she's doing. I need to be doing that. If I was doing that, then I would be, you know, in a better place. Oh, look what she's doing. I wish I could do that. Oh, because I can't do that, I'm not going to do anything. Right? And we spend so much time looking around at what everybody else is doing, and we miss the need that God has put right here. Because you know what kind of need God's going to put in your path? A need that you have the ability to meet. A need that you have the ability to meet. Maybe it's sending a card. Maybe it's giving a hug. Maybe it's giving somebody a bottle of water. Maybe it's teaching a Bible class. I don't know. But whatever it is, there is a need that God has put right in front of you. And sometimes I'm so busy at looking what everybody else is doing and wishing I could do that, that I miss what God has given me to do. I'm going to talk for just a minute to young mothers, okay? You are my heroes. I'm just going to tell you right now. The way that you are bringing your babies to church, the way that you have your babies in Bible class, is amazing. My kids are older now. Emily will be 25 in a couple weeks, and 22 and 19. I'm coming out on the other side of that thing. And I know that bringing them to church on Sunday night, on Wednesday night, Sunday morning, gets them out of their routine, and they're cranky. And Mondays and Thursdays used to be the worst possible days at my house because, you know, we were out of routine, and everybody was grouchy and crying. I was crying. And it was hard. It was hard. And I can remember I was at church, and I had diaper bags and babies and Bibles and, you know, and there was a lady named Mrs. Smith, and she would always stop and look at the babies, you know, and kiss on them and whatever. And one day she kind of paused and hung around a little bit longer than she normally did. And she looked at me, and I must have had whatever look on my face, okay? Just that exhausted mom look, because she looked at me and she said, "You're doing a good job." And then she went on. That was 25 years ago. And that moment still means so much to me. And I'm here to tell you, young moms, that there is not a grumpy day. There is not a missed ball practice. There is not a lost shoe that on this side of that I regret. You will not regret the sacrifices you're making in raising your kids for Jesus. I read a quote by Andy Stanley, and it said, "The greatest contribution that you're making to the kingdom of God may not be what you do. It may be who you raise." And so that's how I want to encourage you young moms today. It may be that raising your kids is the need that God has put right in front of you. Because sometimes I think young moms, I remember this going, well, if I didn't have kids, my kids are in the way of my serving God. They're not. And it doesn't matter if they're babies or elementary school kids or teenagers or where they are. What you're doing for your kids, you're doing for the Lord. Okay? And I want to encourage you in that. The same is true for you grandmothers. And you, those of you who are aunts, and those of you who have just taken kids under your wing, there are lots of kids in these churches that need your love, okay? So if you're a single woman, there are kids for you to love. I guarantee it. But there are places that kids need love. Meet the need that's right in front of you, no matter what it is. Maybe it's a casserole. Maybe it's something else. The third thing, then, would be, and this is probably the hardest one, is we need to measure success by obedience. We need to measure success by obedience. The reason that that's important is because sometimes I want to measure success by how much change I see within 12 seconds, right? I want to do something, and I want to do something great for God, and I want it to be successful, and I want it to be successful in 12 seconds. I like miracle grow. That works for me, okay? And so, but you know, sometimes we don't get to see success. Sometimes the butterfly flaps its wings in China and never knows what happens to the hurricane in Houston. Does that make sense? That effect, the Esther effect, that's in God's hands. That's not in our hands. Ours is to be obedient. Ours is to do what God has called us to do. Leave the power of the change where it belongs, in the hands of God. Does that make sense? And so that's where we are. Richard Bach said, a tiny change today brings a dramatically different tomorrow. A tiny change today brings a dramatically different tomorrow. And that's the essence of the Esther effect, that you, in your ordinary, regular stuff, every time you stand up and say, I'm going to be the woman God has called me to be, you're flapping your wings, just like the butterfly. We don't know how God's going to use that, but we do know he will use that. And that's the power of living in the Esther effect. Thank you all so much. I appreciate being with you.